and he knew she was probably weighing her options. She was in her second year, and social and school demands on her time had grown exponentially from the previous year, resulting in Bosch seeing her less and less. It was a development that occasionally left him feeling sad and alone, but delighted for her at most other times. He knew that this would be one of the nights he would feel gloomy if he didn't get to see her. The story of Viviana Duarte, what little he knew of it, depressed him. She had been just a few years younger than his own daughter, and what happened to her was a reminder that life is not always fair, even to the innocent. While he was waiting for his daughter's decision, Flora came out with two reels of microfilm for him. He put his phone down on the table next to the machine and spooled the reel marked January 1951. He started wading through hundreds of birth records, checking the hospital line on each and printing out every certificate recorded as a home birth. 90 minutes later, Bosch stopped at February 20th, 1951, having extended his search a week past Viviana's death to account for the delay in the filing of a birth certificate under the names of the new parents. He had printed out 67 birth certificates, in which there was a home birth, and the child's race was listed as either Latino or white. He had no photo of Viviana Duarte, and he did not know how dark or light her complexion had been. He could not rule out the possibility that her baby was adopted as white, even if just to match the race of the adoptive parents. As he squared up the stack of printouts, he realized he had forgotten about dinner with his daughter. He grabbed his phone and saw that he had missed her final text on his offer. It had come in more than an hour earlier, and she had accepted, as long as they were finished eating, and she was back studying by 7:30. This year she was sharing a house with three other girls a few blocks from campus. Bosch checked his watch, and saw he'd been correct in predicting he would finish up as the records office was closing. He shot a quick text to Maddie saying he was heading her way. Bosch brought the microfilm copies to the counter and asked Flora what he owed for 67 birth certificates. "You law enforcement," she said. "No charge." "Yeah, but I'm not saying that, Flora," he said. "This is private." Again, he refused to play the San Fernando card where it was not necessary. He had no choice when it came to running names through law enforcement databases, but this was different. If he accepted free copies under false pretenses, then there would be financial gain to his bending the rules and the blowback could be extreme. He pulled out his wallet. "Then you pay $5 for every copy," Flora said. The price shocked him, even though he had made $10,000 that very morning. It must have shown on his face. Flora smiled. "You see," she said, "you are law enforcement." "No, Flora, I'm not," Bosch said. "Can I pay with a credit card?" "No, you pay cash." Bosch frowned and looked through his billfold to get the secreted $100 bill he always carried for emergencies. He combined it with the cash he carried in a fold in his pocket and made the $335 copy bill with $6 left over. He asked for a receipt, even though he didn't think he would be filing an expense report with Vance. He waved the stack of printouts as a farewell and thank you to Flora and left the office. A few minutes later, he was in his car, lining up to get out of the parking lot with everybody else leaving the government building at 5 o'clock sharp. He put the CD player on and switched things up a bit, listening to the latest album from Grace Kelly, the saxophonist. She was one of the few jazz musicians his daughter liked and appreciated. He wanted to have the disc playing in the car in case Maddie chose a restaurant they had to drive to. But instead his daughter chose a place in the old town circle that was walking distance from her house on Palm Avenue. Along the way, she explained how much happier she was renting a house with three girls than she'd been sharing a two-room, one-bathroom dorm as she did her freshman year. She was also much closer to the satellite campus where the psychology school was located. All in all, life seemed good for her, but Bosch worried about security at the private house. There was no campus police patrol. The four girls were left on their own in the jurisdiction of the City of Orange Police Department. The drop-off and response time between the campus and the municipal law enforcement was minutes, not seconds, and that bothered Bosch, too. The restaurant was a pizza joint where they stood in line to each order a customized pie that they took to their table hot from the oven. Sitting across from her, Bosch was distracted by the neon-pink highlights accenting his daughter's hair. Finally, he asked why she had gone and done that to herself. Solidarity, she said. I have a friend whose mom has breast cancer. Bosch didn't get the connection, and she easily read him. Are you kidding, she said. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Dad. You should know that. Oh, yeah, right, I forgot. He had recently seen on TV some football players from the Los Angeles Rams wearing some pink equipment. Now he understood. And while it made him happy that Maddie had dyed her hair for a good cause, he was also secretly pleased that it was probably only a temporary thing. In a few weeks, the month would be over. Maddie ate exactly half of her pizza and put the other half in a cardboard to-go box, explaining that the remainder would serve as breakfast. So what case are you on? She asked when they were walking back down Palm to her house. How do you know I'm on a case? He asked. You said in your text, plus you're wearing a suit. Don't be so paranoid. You're like a secret agent or something. I forgot. It's just an air hunting case. Air hunting? What is that? Heir, like an heir to the throne? Oh, got it. I'm trying to find out if an old man up in Pasadena with a lot of money has an heir out there that he can give it all to when he dies. Wow, cool. Did you find anybody yet? Well, I have 67 possibilities at the moment. That's what I was doing in Norwalk, looking at birth records. Cool. He didn't want to tell her what had happened to Viviana Duarte. But you can't tell anyone about this, Mads. It's top secret, whether I'm a secret agent or not. Like, who am I going to tell? I don't know. I just don't want you putting it out there on my face or Snapchat or something. Funny, Dad, but my generation is visual. We don't tell people what other people are doing. We show what we're doing. We put up photos. So you don't need to worry. Good. Once back at the house, he asked if he could come in to check the locks and other security measures. With the landlord's permission, he had added extra locks on all doors and windows back in September. He checked everything and couldn't avoid thoughts of the screen cutter as he moved about the house. He finally stepped into the small backyard to make sure the wooden fence that ran the perimeter was locked from the inside. He saw that Maddie had done as he had advised, and bought a dog bowl for the back step, even though the girls didn't have a dog, and the landlord didn't allow it. Everything seemed in order, and he reminded his daughter once again not to sleep with any windows open. He then hugged her and kissed the top of her head before leaving. Make sure there's water in the dog bowl, he said. Right now it's dry. Yes, Dad, she said in that tone she had. Otherwise, it doesn't sell it. Okay, I get it. Good. I'll pick up a couple beware of dog signs at Home Depot and bring them down next time. Dad! Okay, I'm going. He gave her another hug and headed back to his car. He had not seen any of the roommates during his brief stop-off. He wondered about this, but didn't ask for fear Maddie would accuse him of invading the privacy of the other girls. She had already told him once before that his questions about them bordered on being creepy. Once he got in the car, he wrote a note to himself about the beware of dog signs, and then put the key into the ignition. The traffic had thinned by the time he headed north for home. He felt good about the accomplishments of the day, including having dinner with his daughter. The next morning, he would work on narrowing the search for Viviana Duarte and Whitney Vance's child. The child's name had to be somewhere in the stack of birth certificates on the seat next to him. There was something comforting about making progress on the Vance case, but a low-grade dread was building inside of him about the screen cutter. Something told him that the stalking rapist was watching another victim and preparing for his next assault. There was a clock ticking up in San Fernando. He was sure of it. Chapter 9. In the morning, Bosch made coffee and had it out on the rear deck where he sat at the picnic table with the copies of the birth certificates he had printed the day before. He studied the names and dates on the documents, but quickly came to the conclusion that he had nothing with which to narrow the focus. None of the certificates were dated in a timely way. Each was issued at least 3 days after the birth, and this precluded him from looking at delayed issuance as an indicator of adoption. He decided his best bet was to somehow go through St. Helens. He knew this would be a difficult path. Privacy laws governing adoptions were difficult to break through, even with a badge and authority. He considered calling his client Vance and asking if he wanted to get a lawyer involved in a request to open up the adoption records regarding the child born to Viviana Duarte, but he decided it was a non-starter. That move would most likely announce Vance's plans to the world, and he had been vehement about secrecy. Bosch remembered the Time story on St. Helens and went inside to get his laptop so he could finish reading it. He brought the stack of birth certificates inside so they wouldn't blow away and paper the canyon below his house. The Time story recounted the transformation of St. Helens, from a place where mother and child were quickly separated when adoption occurred, to a place in more recent decades where many mothers kept their children after birth and were counseled on returning to society with them. The social stigma of unwed pregnancy in the 1950s gave way to the acceptance of the 1990s, and St. Helens had a number of successful programs designed to keep fledgling families together. The story then branched out to a section containing quotes from women who had been clients of St. Helens, saying how their lives were saved by the maternity center that took them in when they were banished in embarrassment by their own families. There were no negative voices here. No interviews with women who felt betrayed by a society that literally snatched their children away from them and gave them to strangers. The final anecdote of the story drew Bosch's rapt attention as he realized it gave his investigation a new angle. It began with a number of quotes from a 72-year-old woman who had come to St. Helens in 1950 to bear a child and then stayed for the next 50 years. Abigail Turnbull was only 14 when she left with a suitcase on the front steps of St. Helens. She was 3 months pregnant, and this deeply humiliated her fervently religious parents. They abandoned her. Her boyfriend abandoned her. And she had nowhere else to go. She had her child at St. Helens and gave her up for adoption, spending less than an hour with the infant girl in her arms. But she had nowhere to go afterward. No one in her family wanted her back. She was allowed to stay on at St. Helens and was given menial jobs, like mopping floors and doing laundry. Over the years, however, she attended night school and eventually earned both high school and college degrees. She became a social worker at St. Helens, counseling those who had been in her position and staying until her retirement, a half century in all. Turnbull gave the keynote speech at the 100-year celebration, and in it she recounted a story that she said showed her how dedication to St. Helens paid off in immeasurable ways. "One day I was in the staff lounge, and one of our girls came in with the message that there was a woman at the entrance lobby who had come because she was tracing her own adoption. She wanted answers about where she had come from. Her parents had told her she was born here at St. Helens. So I met with her, and right away a strange feeling came over me. It was her voice, her eyes. I felt as though I knew her. I asked her what her birthday was, and she said April 9th, 1950. And then I knew she was my child. I put my arms around her and everything went away. All my pain, every regret I ever had. And I knew it was a miracle. And that was why God had kept me at St. Helens." The Times report ended with Turnbull introducing her daughter, who was in attendance, and described how Turnbull's speech had not left a dry eye on the house. "Jackpot," Bosch whispered as he finished reading. Bosch knew he had to speak to Turnbull. As he wrote her name down, he hoped that she was still alive, 8 years after the Times story was published. That would make her 80 years old. He thought about the best way to get to her quickly and started by putting her name into the search engine on his laptop. He got several hits on pay-to-enter search sites, but he knew most of these were bait-and-switch jobs. There was an Abigail Turnbull on LinkedIn, the business-oriented social networking site, but Bosch doubted it was the octogenarian he was looking for. Finally, he decided to put the digital world aside and try what his daughter called social engineering. He pulled up the website for St. Helens, got the phone number, and punched it into his phone. A woman answered after 3 rings. "St. Helens, how can we help you?" Yes, hello, Bosch started, hoping to sound like a nervous caller. "Can I please speak to Abigail Turnbull? I mean, if she's still there." "Oh, honey, she hasn't been here in years." Oh, no, I mean, is she... Do you know if she's still alive? I know she must be very old now. I believe she is still with us. She retired a long time ago, but she didn't die. I think Abby will outlive us all. Bosch felt a glimmer of hope that he would be able to find her. He pressed on. I saw her at the anniversary party. My mother and I spoke to her then. That was 8 years ago. Who, may I ask, is calling, and what is this regarding? My name is Dale. I was born at St. Helens. My mother always spoke of Abigail Turnbull as being such a friend and taking such good care of her during our time there. Like I said, I got to finally meet her when we went back for the anniversary. How can I help you, Dale? Well, it's sad, actually. My mother just passed, and she had a message she wanted me to give Abigail. I also wanted to tell her when the services were in case she wanted to attend. I have a card. Do you know what would be the best way for me to get it to her? You could send it here, addressed to her in care of St. Helens. We'll make sure she gets it. Yes, I know I could do that, but I'm afraid it might take too long. You know, going through a third party. She might not get it until after the services this Sunday. There was a pause, and then, "Hold on, and let me see what we can do." The connection went silent, and Bosch waited. He thought he had played it just about right. 2 minutes later, the voice came back on the line. "Hello? Yes, I'm still here." "Okay. We don't normally do this, but I have an address here that you can use to mail a card to Abigail. I can't give out her phone number without her permission, and I just tried and couldn't reach her." "The address will be fine, then. If I put it in the mail today, she should get it in time." The woman proceeded to give Bosch an address on Vineland Boulevard in Studio City. He wrote it down, thanked her, and quickly got off the phone. Bosch looked at the address. It would be a quick drive from his house down into the valley in Studio City. The address included a unit number, which made him think it could be a retirement home, considering Turnbull's age. There might be real security involved beyond the usual gates and buttons found at every apartment complex in the city. Bosch grabbed a rubber band out of a kitchen drawer and stretched it around the stack of birth certificates. He wanted to take them with him, just in case. He grabbed his keys and was heading toward the side door when there was a hard knock at the front of the house. Changing course, he went to the front door. The unnamed security man who had escorted Bosch through the Vance house the day before was standing on the front step. "Mr. Bosch, I'm glad I caught you," he said. His eyes fell on the banded stack of birth certificates, and Bosch reflexively dropped the hand that held them down and behind his left thigh. Annoyed that he had made such an obvious move to hide them, he spoke abruptly. "What can I do for you?" he said. "I'm on my way out." "Mr. Vance sent me," the man said. "He wanted to know if you have made any progress." Bosch looked at him for a long moment. "What's your name?" he finally asked. "You never said it yesterday." "Sloan. I'm in charge of security at the Pasadena estate." "How did you find out where I live?"
"I looked it up."
"Looked it up where? I'm not listed anywhere, and the deed to this house isn't in my name."
"We have ways of finding people, Mr. Bosch."
Bosch looked at him for a long moment before responding.
"Well, Sloan, Mr. Vance told me to talk only to him about what I was doing, so if you'll excuse me."
Bosch started to close the door, and Sloan immediately put his hand out and stopped it.
"You really don't want to do that," Bosch said.
Sloan backed off and held his hands up.
"I apologize," he said.
"But I must tell you, Mr. Vance took ill yesterday after speaking with you. He sent me this morning to ask you if you've made any headway."
"Headway with what?" Bosch asked.
"With the job you were hired to do." Bosch held up a finger.
"Can you wait here 1 minute?" he asked.
He didn't wait for an answer. He closed the door and put the stack of birth certificates under his arm. He went to the dining room table, where he had left the business card with the direct number to Vance printed on it. He punched in the number on his phone and then went back to the front door, opening it while listening to his call ringing.
"Who are you calling?" Sloan asked.
"Your boss," Bosch said. "Just want to make sure he's okay with our discussing the case."
"He won't answer."
"Yeah, well, we'll just..." The call clicked over to a long beep without an outgoing message from Vance.
"Mr. Vance, this is Harry Bosch. Please call me back." Bosch recited his number, disconnected, and then spoke to Sloan.
You know what I don't get? I don't get Vance sending you here to ask that question without first telling you what the job is he hired me to do. I told you he is taken ill.
Yeah, well, then I'll wait until he's better. Tell him to call me then. Bosch read the look of hesitation on Sloan's face. There was something else.
He waited, and Sloan finally delivered.
Mr. Vance also has reason to believe the phone number he gave you has been compromised. He wants you to report through me. I've been in charge of his personal security for 25 years.
Yeah. Well, he'll have to tell me that himself. When he gets better, you let me know, and I'll come back out there to the palace.
Bosch swung the door closed, and it caught Sloan by surprise. It banged loudly in its frame. Sloan knocked on it again, but by then Bosch was quietly opening the side door to the carport. He exited the house, then stealthily opened the door of his Cherokee and got in. The moment the engine turned over, he dropped the vehicle into reverse and backed out quickly into the road. He saw a copper-colored sedan parked pointing downhill across the street. Sloan was walking toward it. Bosch turned the wheel and backed out to his right, then gunned the Cherokee uphill, speeding by Sloan at the door to his car. He knew Sloan would have to use the carport to turn around in the narrow street, a maneuver that would give Bosch enough time to lose him. After 25 years of living there, taking the curves of Woodrow Wilson Drive came as second nature to Bosch. He quickly arrived at the stop sign at Mulholland Drive and banged a hard right without pausing. He then followed the asphalt snake along the mountain ridgeline until he reached Wrightwood Drive. He checked his mirrors and saw no sign of Sloan or any other follow car. He took the sharp right onto Wrightwood and quickly descended the northern slope into Studio City, hitting the valley floor at Ventura Boulevard. A few minutes later, he was on Vineland, parked against the curb in front of an apartment complex called the Sierra Winds. It was built next to the 101 freeway overpass and looked old and worn. There was a 20-foot concrete sound barrier wall running along the curve of the freeway, but Bosch imagined that the sound of the traffic still swept across the sprawling two-story complex like a Sierra wind. The important thing was that Abigail Turnbull was not living in a retirement center after all. Bosch would have no trouble getting to her door, and that was a good break.
Chapter 10 Bosch loitered near the gated entrance to the apartment complex and acted like he was on a phone call, when all he was really doing was replaying a year-old message his daughter had left him after she had accepted admission to Chapman University.
Dad, it's a really exciting day for me, and I want to thank you for all your help in getting me to this point. And I am so glad I won't be too far away from you, and that whenever we need each other, we will only be an hour away.
Okay, well, maybe two because of traffic?
He smiled. He didn't know how long messages would be retained on his phone, but he hoped he would always be able to listen to the pure joy he heard in his daughter's voice. He saw a man approaching the gate from the other side, and timed his approach to reach it at the same time. He acted like he was trying to carry on a phone conversation while digging his key to the gate out of his pocket.
"That's great," he said into the phone. "I feel the same way about it, too."
The man on the other side pushed open the gate to exit. Bosch mumbled a thank you and entered. He preserved the message from his daughter one more time and put his phone away. Signs along the stone pathway directed him to the building he was looking for, and he found Abigail Turnbull's apartment on the first floor. As he approached, he saw that the front door was open behind a screen door. He heard a voice from within the apartment.
"All done, Abigail?"
He stepped closer without knocking and looked through the screen. He could see down a short hallway into a living room, where an old woman was sitting on a couch with a folding table in front of her. She looked old and frail and had on thick glasses and an obvious wig of brown hair. Another woman, much younger, was clearing a dish off the table and gathering silverware. The woman Bosch assumed was Abigail was just finishing a late breakfast or early lunch. Bosch decided to wait to see if the caregiver would be leaving after cleaning up. The apartment fronted a small courtyard, where the water tumbling down a three-level fountain masked most of the freeway noise. It was most likely the reason Turnbull was able to leave her door open. Vash took a seat on a precast concrete bench in front of the fountain and put the stack of birth certificates down next to him. He checked his phone for messages while he waited. No more than 5 minutes later, he heard the voice from the apartment again.
"You want the door left open, Abigail?"
Vash heard a muffled reply and watched as the caregiver stepped out of the apartment, carrying an insulated bag for transporting meals. Vash recognized it as belonging to a charitable meal delivery service for shut-ins that his daughter had volunteered for while she was a senior in high school. He realized that she might have delivered meals to Abigail Turnbull. The woman followed the path toward the gate. Vash waited a moment, and then approached the screen door and looked in. Abigail Turnbull was still seated on the couch. The folding table was gone, and in its place in front of her was a walker with two wheels. She was staring across the room at something Vash could not see, but he thought he could hear the low murmur of a television. "Miss Turnbull?" He said it loudly in case she had hearing loss, but his voice startled her, and she looked fearfully toward the screen door. "I'm sorry," Vash said quickly. "I didn't mean to startle you. I'm wondering if I could ask you a few questions." She looked around her, as if to see if she had anyone with her as backup if needed.
"What do you want?" she said.
"I'm a detective," Vash said. "I want to ask you about a case I'm working on."
"I don't understand. I don't know any detectives."
Vash tried the screen door. It was unlocked. He opened it halfway so that she could see him better. He held his SFPD badge up and smiled. "I'm working on an investigation, and I think you could help me, Abigail," he said. The woman who had delivered her meal had called her by her full first name. He thought he would try. Turnbull didn't reply, but Vash could see her hands ball into nervous fists. "Do you mind if I come in?" he said. "This will only take a few minutes."
"I don't have visitors," she said. "I don't have any money to buy anything."
Vash slowly entered the hallway. He kept a smile on his face, even though he felt bad about scaring the old woman. "I'm not trying to sell you anything, Abigail, I promise." He stepped down the hallway and into the small living room. The TV was on, and Ellen DeGeneres was on the screen. There was only the couch and a kitchen chair set in the corner of the room. Behind it there was a small kitchenette and a half-size refrigerator. He put the birth certificates under one arm and pulled his SFPD ID out of his badge wallet. She reluctantly took it from him and studied it.
"San Fernando," she said. "Where is that?"
"Not too far," he said.
"What are you investigating?"
"I'm looking for someone from a long time ago."
"I don't understand why you want to talk to me.
I've never been to San Fernando." Vash pointed to the chair against the wall. "Do you mind if I sit down?"
"Go ahead. I still don't know what you want with me."
Vash pulled the chair over and sat down in front of her, her walker between them. She wore a loose-fitting house dress with a faded pattern of flowers on it. She was still looking at his ID card.
"How do you say this name?" she asked.
"Hieronymus," Vash said. "I was named after a painter."
"I've never heard of him."
"You're not alone. I read the article that was in the paper a few years ago about St. Helens. It had the story you told at the anniversary party, about your daughter coming there for answers and finding you."
"What about it?"
"I'm working for a man, a very old man, who is looking for answers. His child was born at St. Helens, and I'm hoping you could help me find him or her." She leaned back, as if to remove herself from the discussion, and shook her head.
"So many children were born there," she said, "and I was there for 50 years. I can't remember all of the babies. Most of them got new names when they left."
Vash nodded. "I know, but this, I think, was a special case. I think you'd remember the mother. Her name was Viviana. Viviana Duarte. I'm talking about the year after you got to St. Helens." Turnbull closed her eyes as if to ward off a great pain. Vash knew instantly that she knew and remembered Viviana, that his journey back through time had found a destination. "You remember her, don't you?" he said. Turnbull nodded once.
"I was there," she said. "It was an awful day."
"Can you tell me about it?"
"Why? It's a long time ago."
Vash nodded. It was a valid question. "Remember when your daughter came to St. Helens and found you? You called it a miracle. It's like that. I'm working for a man who wants to find his child, the child he had with Viviana. Bosch could see the anger work into her face and immediately regretted his choice of words. It's not the same, she said. He wasn't forced to give up his baby. He abandoned Vivi, and he abandoned his son. Bosch quickly tried to repair the damage, but he noted that she had said the child was a boy. I know that, Abigail, he said. Not the same at all, I know that. But it's a parent who is looking for his child. He's old, and he's going to die soon. He has a lot to pass on. It won't make up for things, of course not. But is that our call, or the son's call to make? Do we not even allow the son to make that choice? She remained quiet while considering Bosch's words. I can't help you, she finally said. I have no idea what happened to that boy after the day they took him. Just, if you can tell me what you do know, Bosch said. I know it's an awful story, but tell me what happened, if you can, and tell me about Vivi's son. Turnbull cast her eyes down toward the floor. Bosch knew she was seeing the memory, and that she was going to tell the story. She reached out both hands and gripped her walker, as if reaching for support. He was frail, that one, she began. Born underweight. We had a rule. No baby could go home until it weighed at least 5 pounds. What happened? Bosch asked. Well, the couple that was there to take him couldn't. Not like that. He needed to be healthier and heavier. So the adoption was delayed? Sometimes it happened like that. Delayed. They told Vivi she had to get weight on him. She had to keep him in her room and feed him with her milk. Feed him all the time to get him healthy and get his weight up. How long did that last? A week? Maybe longer. All I know is that Vivi got that time with her baby that nobody else ever got with theirs. That I never got. And then after that week, it was time for the switch. The couple came back, and the adoption proceeded. They took Vibby's baby. Bosch glumly nodded. The story got worse from every angle. What happened to Vivi? He asked. My job back then was in the laundry, she said. There wasn't a lot of money. There were no dryers. We hung everything on the clotheslines in the field behind the kitchen, before they built the addition there. Anyway, the morning after the adoption, I took sheets out to hang, and I saw that one of the clotheslines was missing. Viviana. And then I heard. One of the girls told me. Vivi had hanged herself. She had gone into the bathroom and tied the rope to one of the shower pipes. They found her in there, but it was too late. She was dead. Turnbull looked down. It was as if she didn't want to make eye contact with Bosch over such a horrible story. Bosch was repelled by the tale. It sickened him, but he needed more. He needed to find Viviana's son. So that was it, he asked. The boy was taken and never came back. Once they were gone, they were gone. You remember his name? The name of the couple who adopted him? Vivi called him Dominic. I don't know if the name stayed with him. They usually didn't. I called my daughter Sarah. When she came back to me, her name was Kathleen. Bosch pulled up the stack of birth certificates. He was sure he remembered seeing the name Dominic when he had gone through the documents that morning on the back deck. He started quickly moving through the stack again, looking for the name. When he found it, he studied the full name and date. Dominic Santanella was born on January 31, 1951, but his birth wasn't registered with the recorder's office until 15 days later. He knew the delay was probably caused by the baby's weight postponing the adoption. He showed the sheet to Turnbull. Is this him? He asked. Dominic Santanello? I told you, Turnbull said. I only know what she called him. It's the only birth certificate with Dominic on it from that time period. It's got to be him. It's listed as a home birth, which was how they did it back then. Then I guess you found who you're looking for. Bosch glanced at the birth certificate. In the boxes denoting the race of the child, HISP was checked. The Santanello family's address was in Oxnard in Ventura County. Luca and Audrey Santanello, both of them 26 years old. Luca Santanello's occupation was listed as appliance salesman. Bosch noticed that Abigail Turnbull's hands tightly gripped the aluminum tubes of her walker. Thanks to her, Bosch believed he had found Whitney Vance's long-missing child, but the price had been high. Bosch knew he would carry the story of Viviana Duarte with him for a long time. Chapter 11. Bosch drove west from the Sierra Winds until he hit Laurel Canyon Boulevard and then pointed the car north. It might have been quicker to jump on a freeway, but Bosch wanted to take his time and think about the story Abigail Turnbull had told him. He needed to grab something to eat as well and went through an In-N-Out drive-thru. After eating in his car on the side of the road, he pulled out his phone and hit redial on the last number he had called. The number Whitney Vance had given him. Once again, the call went unanswered, and he left a message. "Mr. Vance, Harry Bosch again. I need you to call me back. I believe I have the information you've been looking for." He disconnected, put the phone in the center console's cup holder, and pulled back into traffic. It took him another 20 minutes to finish crossing the valley south to north on Laurel Canyon. At McClay, he turned right and drove into San Fernando. Once again, the detective bureau was empty when he entered, and he went directly to his cubicle. The first thing he checked for was email to his SFPD account. He had 2 new messages, and he could tell from the subject line that they were both returns on his inquiries regarding the screen cutter case. The first was from a detective in LAPD's West Valley Division. "Dear Harry Bosch, if you are the former LAPD detective of the same name who sued the department he served for 30-plus years, then I hope you get ass cancer real soon and die a slow and painful death. If you are not him, then my bad. Have a good day." Bosch read the message twice and felt his blood get hot. It was not because of the sentiment expressed. He didn't care about that. He hit the reply button on the email and quickly typed in a response. "Detective Mattson, I'm glad to know the investigators in West Valley Division carry on with the level of professionalism the citizens of Los Angeles have come to expect. Choosing to insult the requester of information rather than consider the request shows immense dedication to the department's mandate to serve and protect. Thanks to you, I know that the sexual predators in the West Valley live in fear." Bosch was about to hit the send button when he thought better of it and deleted the message. He tried to put his upset aside. At least Mattson wasn't a detective working in either of the LAPD's Mission or Foothill divisions, where he felt sure the screen cutter must have been active. He moved on and opened up the second email. It was from a detective in Glendale. It was just an acknowledgement that Bosch's request for information had been received and passed to him for action. The detective said he would ask around his department and get back to Bosch as soon as possible. Bosch had received several similar emails in his response to blind inquiries. Luckily, only a few like Mattson's had come in. Most detectives he had contacted were professional, and while overrun with cases and work, they promised to get to Bosch's request quickly. He closed down the email page and went to the department's DMV portal. It was time to find Dominic Santinello. As he logged in, Bosch did the math on the birth date in his head. Santinello would be 65 years old now, maybe newly retired, maybe living on a pension, with no idea that he was heir to a fortune. Bosch wondered if he had ever left his adoptive hometown of Oxnard. Did he know that he was adopted, and that his mother's life had ended as his began? Bosch typed in the name and birth date from the birth certificate, and the database quickly kicked back a match, but it was a very short entry. It showed that Dominic Santinello had received a California driver's license on January 31, 1967, the day he turned 16 and was eligible to drive. But the license had never been renewed or surrendered. The last entry in the record simply said deceased. Bosch leaned back in his seat, feeling as though he had been kicked in the gut. He had been on the case less than 36 hours, but he was invested. Viviana's story, Abigail's story. Vance's being unable to outrun the guilt of his actions all these decades later. And now to come to this. According to the DMV, Vance's son died even before his first driver's license had expired. "Harry, are you all right?" Bosch looked left and saw that Bella Lourdes had entered the bureau and was heading to her cubicle across the partition wall from his.
I'm fine, Bosch said. Just another dead end.
I know the feeling, Lourdes said. She sat down and dropped from his sight. She was no more than 5'2", and the partition made her disappear. Bosch just stared at his computer screen. There were no details about Santanello's death, only that it occurred during the licensing period. Bosch had gotten his first California license the year before Santanello, in 1966. He was pretty sure that back then the license period was 4 years before renewal. It meant Santanello had died between the ages of 16 and 20. He knew that when he reported the death of his client's son, he would have to provide Vance with full and convincing details. He also knew that back in the late 1960s, most teenagers who died were killed in car accidents or in the war. He leaned back toward the computer terminal, brought up the search page, and typed in "search the wall." This led him to links to a number of websites associated with the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., where the names of every one of the 58,000-plus soldiers killed during the war were etched on a black granite wall. Bosch chose the site operated by the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund because he had been to the site before, both as a donor and to look up the details of men he had served with and knew hadn't made it back home. He now typed in the name Dominic Santanello, and his hunch became reality as a page opened with a photo of the soldier and the details of his service. Before reading anything, Bosch stared at the image. Until this point, there had been no photos of any of the principals of the investigation. He had only conjured images of Bibiana and Dominic. But there on the screen was the black-and-white portrait of Santanello in suit and tie and smiling at the camera. Maybe it was a high school yearbook picture or a shot taken during his military induction. The young man had dark hair and even darker, piercing eyes. Even in the black-and-white photo, it was clear to Bosch that he was a mixture of Caucasian and Latino genes. Bosch studied the eyes and thought it was there that he saw the resemblance to Whitney Vance. Bosch was instinctively sure that he was looking at the old man's son. The page dedicated to Santanello listed the panel and line number where his name was etched on the Vietnam Memorial. It also carried the basic details of his service and casualty. Bosch wrote these down in his notebook. Santanello was listed as a Navy corpsman. His date of enlistment was June 1, 1969, just 4 months after he turned 18 years old. His date of casualty was December 9, 1970, in the Thái Ninh province. His assigned base at the time of his casualty was the 1st Medical Battalion, Da Nang. Location of final internment was listed as the Los Angeles National Cemetery. Bosch had served with the U.S. Army in Vietnam as a tunnel engineer, more commonly referred to as a tunnel rat. The specialty assignment put him on call-outs to many of the different provinces and combat zones where enemy tunnel networks had been discovered and needed to be cleared. It also put him to work with soldiers from all branches of service, Air Force, Navy, Marines. It gave him a rudimentary overview and knowledge of the war effort that allowed him to interpret the basic details supplied on the memorial site about Dominic Santanello. Bosch knew that Navy corpsmen were the medics that backed the Marines. Every Marine recon unit had an attached corpsman. Though Santanello's assignment was to 1st Med Da Nang, his death in the Thái Ninh province, which ran along the Cambodian border, told Bosch that Santanello was on a recon mission when he was killed. The memorial site was set up to list soldiers by date of casualty, because the memorial itself listed the names of the dead on the wall in the chronological order of their deaths. This meant that Bosch could click on the right and left arrows on his screen and see the names and details of the soldiers who were killed on the same day as Santanello. He did this now and determined there were a total of 8 men killed in the Thái Ninh province on December 9, 1970. The war killed young men by the dozens almost every day, but Bosch thought that 8 men dead in the same province on the same day was unusual. It had to have been an ambush or a friendly fire bomb drop. He studied the soldiers' ranks and assignments and identified them all as Marines, with 2 of them being pilots and 1 being a door gunner. This was a revelation. Bosch knew that door gunners flew on slicks, the transport helicopters that carried soldiers in and out of the bush. He now realized that Dominic Santanello had gone down in a helicopter. He had been killed in an aircraft that his unknown father had probably helped manufacture. The cruel irony of it was stunning to Bosch. He wasn't sure how he would break that kind of news to Whitney Vance.
"Are you sure you're okay?"
Bosch looked up and saw Lourdes looking over the separation wall into his cubicle. Her eyes were on the stack of birth certificates Bosch had put down on his desk.
Yeah, I'm fine," he said quickly. "What's up?"
He tried to put his arm down casually on top of the stack, but the move came off as awkward, and he could see her register it.
"I got an email from a friend that works sex backs at Foothill," Lourdes said. "She said she's found a case that might be related to our guy. No screen cutting, but other aspects match up."
Bosch felt the dread rise in his chest.
"Is it a fresh case?" he asked.
"No, it's old. She was backtracking in her spare time for us and came up with it. It could have been our guy before he started cutting screens."
"Maybe.
You want to go with me?"
No, it's okay, I'll go. You look like you're busy."
"I could go, but if you can handle it."
"Of course.
I'll call you if it's anything to get excited about." Lourdes left the office and Bosch went back to work. To keep his notes complete, he went screen by screen and wrote down the names and details of all the men killed during the mission in Tainan. In doing so, he realized that only one of the men was assigned as a door gunner. Bosch knew there were always two on every slick. Two sides. Two doors. Two gunners. It meant that whether the Tainan slick had been shot down or simply crashed, there might have been a survivor. Before leaving the site, Bosch went back to the page dedicated to Dominic Santanello. He clicked on a button marked Remembrances and was taken to a page where people had left messages honoring Santanello's service and sacrifice. Bosch scrolled through those pages without reading them and judged that there were about 40 messages left over a period beginning in 1999, when Bosch presumed the site was established. He started reading them now, in the order in which they were left, beginning with a message from someone who stated that he was a classmate of Dominic's at Oxnard High and would always remember him for his sacrifice in a land so far away. Some of the remembrances were from total strangers, who simply wished to honor the fallen soldier and had apparently come across his entry randomly. But others, like the high school classmate, clearly had known him. One of these was a man named Bill Bissinger, who identified himself as a former Navy corpsman. He had trained with Santanello in San Diego before they were both shipped out to Vietnam in late 1969 and assigned to medical duties on the hospital ship Sanctuary, anchored on the South China Sea. This bit of information made Bosch pause. He had been on the Sanctuary in late 1969 after being wounded in the tunnel in Cu Chi. He realized that he and Santanello had probably been on the ship at the same time. Bissinger's remembrance gave some clarity to what had happened to Santanello. The fact that it was written as if directly to Dominic made it all the more haunting. "Nikki, I remember being at Chow on Sanctuary when I heard about you getting shot down. The gunner that got burned up but survived had come to us, so we knew the story. I felt so bad. For anybody to die in a place so far from home and for something that didn't seem to mean so much anymore. I remember begging you not to go out there to First Med. I begged you. I said, 'Don't get off the boat, man.' But you didn't listen. You had to get that CMB and see the war. I'm so sorry, man. I feel like I let you down because I couldn't stop you." Bosch knew that CMB meant Combat Medical Badge. Below Bissinger's outpouring of feelings was a comment from another site visitor named Olivia McDonald. "Don't feel so bad, Bill. We all knew Nick and how headstrong he was and how he wanted adventure. He joined up for adventure. He picked medic because he thought he could be in the middle of things, but just help people and not have to kill anybody. That was his spirit, and we should celebrate that, not second-guess our actions." The comment showed an intimate knowledge of Santanello that made Bosch think Olivia was a family member or maybe a former girlfriend. Bissinger had written a return comment, thanking Olivia for her understanding. Bosch continued to scroll through the messages and saw that Olivia McDonald had posted 5 more times over the years, always on November 11th, Veterans Day. These posts were not as intimate, and always along the lines of gone, but not forgotten.
There was a sign-up button at the top of the remembrance page that allowed users to be alerted whenever a new message was posted to the Santanello page. Bosch scrolled back down to the post from Bissinger and saw that Olivia McDonald's comment had come only a day after his original post. Bissinger's thank you to her came on the same day as her post. The quickness of the responses indicated to Bosch that both McDonald and Bissinger had signed up for the post alerts. He quickly opened a comment block under Bissinger's thank you and wrote a message to both of them. He didn't want to reveal exactly what he was doing in a public forum, no matter how infrequently the Dominic Santanello remembrance page was visited. He crafted a message that he hoped would draw at least one of them into making contact. Olivia and Bill, I am a Vietnam vet. I was wounded in 1969 and treated on the sanctuary. I want to talk to you about Nick. I have information. Bosch put both his personal email and cell phone number on the message and then posted it. He hoped he would hear back from one of them soon. Bosch printed out the screen that had Dominic Santanello's photo and then logged off the computer. He closed his notebook and put it in his pocket. He picked up the stack of birth certificates and left the cubicle, taking the copy of the photo out of the communal printer tray as he left the office. Chapter 12. Back in his car, Bosch sat still for a moment and felt guilty about not going to Foothill Division with Bella Lourdes to talk to the detective handling sexual batteries. He was putting his private investigation in front of his work for the town, and it was the screen cutter case that was more pressing. He thought about calling Lourdes and saying he was on his way. But the truth was, Lourdes could handle it. She was going to another police station to confer with another detective. It wasn't a two-person job. Instead, he pulled out of the parking lot and started to cruise. In the course of the investigation, Bosch had been to each of the residences where the screen cutter had attacked women. These visits came as each case was linked to a serial rapist. None of the victims still lived in the homes, and access to them was difficult to arrange and brief. In one case, the victim agreed to return to the premises with the detectives to walk them through the logistics of the crime. Now for the first time, Bosch cruised by each of the homes in the chronological order of the assaults. He wasn't really sure what he might gain from this, but he knew it would help keep the investigation churning in his mind. That was important. He didn't want the Vance investigation to crowd out his resolve to find the screen cutter. It took him no more than 15 minutes to make the circuit. At the last house, he stopped at the curb in front, easily finding parking because it was a street-sweeping day, and one side of the street was clear. He reached under the seat and pulled out the old Thomas Brothers map book. San Fernando was small enough to fit on one page of the book. Bosch had previously charted the locations of the rapes on the page and now studied it once again. There was no discernible pattern to the locations. Bosch and Lourdes had already exhaustively looked for commonalities. Repairmen, postal workers, meter readers, and so on, who might connect the victims or their addresses or neighborhoods. But the effort failed to pay off with a connection to all four of the victims or their addresses. Lourdes believed that each of the victims had somehow come into visual contact with the rapist while away from her home and then was followed during the stalking phase of the crime. But Bosch was unconvinced. San Fernando was a tiny town. The idea that the rapist would lock on to a potential victim in one location and follow her to another stretched believability when 4 out of 4 times this protocol led to an address in Little San Fernando. Bosch believed the victims were somehow acquired when the rapist saw them in or just outside their homes. He turned and studied the front facade of the house where the screen cutter was last known to have attacked. It was a small post-war house with a front porch and a single-car garage. The rapist had cut the screen on a rear window in an unused bedroom. Bosch could see there was perfect cover from the street. A shadow swooped by his side window, and Bosch turned to see a post office van coast up to the curb in front of his car. The mailman got out and headed toward the front door, where there was a mail slot. He casually glanced towards Bosch's car, recognized him behind the wheel, and held a middle finger up his whole way to the door. His name was Mitchell Marin, and he had briefly been a suspect in the rapes, as well as a subject of a backfired attempt to surreptitiously collect his DNA. It had occurred at the Starbucks on Truman a month earlier.
When Bosch and Lourdes found out that Marin delivered mail on a route that included three of the four victims' homes, they decided the quickest way to identify or eliminate him as a suspect was to get his DNA and compare it to that from the rapist. They watched him for 2 days, and while he did nothing that engendered suspicion, he did stop on his morning breaks at the Starbucks, where he drank tea and ate a breakfast sandwich. In a bit of improvising, Lourdes followed Marin into the coffee shop on the third day, purchased an iced tea, and then sat at an outside table next to the mailman. When he was finished eating, he wiped his mouth with a napkin, stuffed it into the empty paper bag his sandwich had come in, and tossed it into a nearby trash can. As he headed back to his mail van, Lourdes took a position guarding the trash can from being used by other patrons. When she saw Marin jump into the van, she removed the top of the trash can and looked down at the paper bag he had just discarded. She put on latex gloves and pulled out a plastic evidence bag to collect the possible DNA specimen. Bosch emerged from the follow car and pulled his phone so he could get a video of the collecting of the bag in case DNA from it was ever introduced in court. The courts had upheld the validity of surreptitious collection of DNA from public locations. He needed to document where the specimen was collected as well. The unforeseen problem was that Marin had left his cell phone on his table and realized it just as he was about to back out of his parking spot. He jumped back out of his van and went to retrieve the phone. Coming across Bosch and Lourdes collecting his discarded debris, he said, "What the fuck are you doing?" At that point, knowing that Marin could flee, the detectives had to treat him as a suspect. They asked him to come to the station to answer questions, and he angrily agreed. During the ensuing interview, he denied any knowledge of the rapes. He acknowledged knowing three of the victims by name, but said that was because he delivered their mail. While Bosch handled the interview, Lourdes was able to round up the four known victims and get them to come in for audio-visual lineups. Because the rapist had worn a mask during each assault, the detectives were hoping an identification might be made by one of the victims recognizing his voice, hands, or eyes. 4 hours after the incident at the coffee shop, Marin voluntarily but sullenly stood in a lineup that was viewed separately by all four women. He held his hands out and read sentences said by the rapist during the assaults. None of them identified him as their assailant. Marin was released that day, and his innocence confirmed a week later, when DNA from the napkin he wiped his mouth with was deemed no match to the DNA of the rapist. The chief of police sent him a letter apologizing for the incident and thanking him for his cooperation. Now after pushing the mail through the slot, Marin walked back toward his van and then made a sudden turn toward Bosch's car. Harry lowered the window to accept the verbal confrontation.
"Hey, I want you to know I hired a lawyer," Marin said. "I'm going to sue all your asses for false arrest."
Bosch nodded like the threat was just par for the course. "I hope it's a contingency deal," he said.
"What the hell are you talking about?" Marin said.
"I hope you're not paying your lawyer. Put it on contingency. That means he gets paid only if he wins. Because you aren't going to win, Mitchell. If he's telling you anything else, he's lying."
"Bullshit."
"You agreed to come in. There was no arrest. We even let you drive the mail van in so nothing would get stolen. You don't have a case, and the only one who will make book are the lawyers. Think about that." Marin leaned down and put his hand on the Jeep's windowsill.
"So I'm just supposed to let it go then?" he said. "I felt like I'm the one who got raped, and it's just never mind."
"Not even close," Mitchell, Bosch said. "You say that to one of the real victims, and they'd put you in your place. What you went through was a shitty couple of hours. There's no end to what they're going through." Marin slapped the sill and stood up straight.
"Fuck you!"
He stalked back to his van and took off, the wheels screeching. The effect was undercut when 60 feet later he had to hit the brakes to make the delivery to the next house down. Bosch's phone rang, and he saw it was Lourdes. "Bella?"
"Harry, where are you?"
"Out and about. How'd it go at Foothill?"
"A non-starter. The cases didn't match."
Bosch nodded. "Oh, well, I just ran into your boy, Mitch Marin. He's still pissed at us."
"At Starbucks?"
"No, I'm in front of Frida Lopez's old house. He just came by to deliver the mail and tell me what a shit I am. Says he's going to hire a lawyer."
"Yeah, good luck with that. What are you doing there?"
Nothing. Just thinking.